This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Well, it's nice to be here with you instead of behind closed doors working in all of this. This is called The Old Woman's Relatives. It's from the 9th century China, from the Hidden Lamp, Stories of Awakened Women. Once a monk on a pilgrimage met an old woman living alone in a hut. The monk asked, "Do you have any relatives?" She said, "Yes." He asked, "Where are they?" She answered, "The mountains, rivers, and the whole earth, the plants and trees are all my relatives." An old woman living alone in a hut. We usually have the starring roles in these koans, making tea by the roadside, living in a hut. Usually the old stories of Chinese Buddhist hermits are men. And here we find a woman living as a hermit in China. And when I looked up for Chinese women hermits living in China under Confucian law, it was very rare. I didn't find actually any. One maybe, I'm not sure. So as I was saying, usually it's very rare that under Confucian law that a Chinese woman is living alone in a hut. It's rare. It was rare in India too. Usually, if she was alone, then she would have to serve the male members of her family, her father, her brother, her husband, her father-in-law, and so on. Or her son. It was neither safe nor allowed, actually, for a woman to live alone. So who is this old woman living alone? Who is this old woman living alone? And how are we each alone, truly alone? Who of us does not live and die alone? Of course, in that broader sense, even if we're in an intimate and healthy, long-lasting relationship, there's still a gap. You and I are the same, but I'm not you, and you're not me. So, when I read this, it feels like this monk asking, it feels a little unsure of himself. He sees her there, and he says, essentially, "Are you here alone? Do you have any relatives? Who knows you're here? Are you permitted to do this? How are you surviving?" Why is he asking you that? He sees an old woman living alone in a hut. "Do you have any relatives?" What's it about?
She says, "Yes." She says, "Yes, I live alone." So this is something I've been delving into myself. What is this, living alone? Here's this old woman, and she turns this question over to the monk. "Yes. Oh, yes, I have relatives. Just look around, dear monk. Everywhere. Trees, mountains, rivers, clouds. Show me one thing. Show me one thing that I'm not related to. Show me one thing that you're not related to." what Buddha taught is neither a path of denial nor of affirmation. He showed us how to live the middle way within seeming paradoxes, living with the tension of the opposites. He showed us how to be fully in the world, but not of the world, not in the spin of conventions or status quo.
So we try and grab onto a side. It's a kind of a steadfast journey, this middle way, to not fall over onto either side, but to learn how to tolerate and accept the edginess of that, of this, not this and not that. It's quite a ridge to not fall to either side. And that's what we often want to do, is trying to grab onto a side, and it's hard to live in that truth of an unresolved state where we just don't know. And the more we delve into the middle way, the more deeply we come to rest in the play of the opposites. It was funny, as I was working on this, a friend of mine sent me a new book that's out called Everything is Figure Outable. Now, I didn't go and look at it because I didn't want to at this, but it's talking about this edginess, right? But I thought this was interesting. She said, women are in such a massive transition now. We are either in the process of activating to new levels of power or knowing that it's time, and despite our fears, we need to activate. We can each feel at a cellular truth level where we are stretching and growing and where we are shrinking. When it boils down to it, the only reason we have been putting a lid on our growth is fear. Fear is so big, we let it stop us. So that's her book, Everything is Figure Outable, that we'll figure out something, that we won't go into that fear or dim down our lights. So I haven't looked at it, but it was just funny that I'm saying there's nothing to figure out, and she's writing a book, Everything is Figure Outable. So Ajahn Chah described this state in a koan, like a koan. He said, there is neither going forward, nor going backward, nor standing still. He said, to discover the middle way, try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings. There's that edge. Okay. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. There is a natural course without our interference. But we have to ride that edge so carefully to not fall onto either side. He says, you will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. So this learning to rest in the middle way is a real trust in the life itself and in the Dharma, which is truth, which can't be given, which isn't written down. It's really not forcing ourselves to manage when we feel this urge to manage. Neither going forward, neither going backward, and standing still. It's this active patience. Okay, it's not like, oh, be patient. It's active patience, right? It's not idle, but it's active patience. Relaxing the figure outable. It's like learning to swim. And I was remembering learning to swim. And, my parents used to call me Jody Fish because when I was young, I had asthma. And I had this wonderful pediatrician. I loved him as a little kid. He was so good. He was like a big boulder. And he had a pockmarked face. That's why I say he was a boulder. And I was so close to his face. And it had all these like boulder dimples. And I liked to look at him. He was like a big potato, which I love. And he was very kind. His nurse was Ratchet, but she was the needle giver, you know. So she was, and she had lipstick that went way over the shape of her lips, and it was bright orange. And she wore that nurse hat, right? It was all white, you know, and very tidy. But he was a sweetheart. And he told my parents to throw me into a pool, not like throw me in, put me in water. Let her start developing her lungs in the pool. And I remember I was very skinny and I used to get very purple and shivery. But I, you know how kids, they don't care if it's cold. Or now I'm such a wimp, but still a fish, but a wimpy fish. But I loved being in the water, and I remember my dad used to handle me a lot, and I would I would stay afloat. And there was a time where there was this magical moment where he wasn't there, and I was floating, and I was just held up when he released by the water itself. So it's kind of like that. It's that kind of feeling of, I remember viscerally now that feeling that I felt in that little body, it's still with me, of him not around. And I was floating and I was actually held up. It was slightly scary, but yet I stayed within it. And it was the beginning of a kind of trust and ease. A cellular knowing that we too can float in this changing ocean that we're in, that life can hold us. So Buddha's teaching invites us to discover this ease everywhere. And you might say, yeah, 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 sure. It's there, it's in us. In meditation, at work, wherever we are. Stillness, spaciousness, and the silence are in our temple, this temple. This is what we're cultivating and developing, and we can turn to it if we remember. That's the key. And I remembered a poem by T.S. Eliot. You probably know it. It's used, it comes up a lot. Because he called it the still point of the turning world, neither from nor towards, neither arrest nor movement, neither flesh nor fleshless. The sage Shantideva calls the middle way complete non-referential ease. So I was taking that in, complete. Can you imagine? Complete non-referential ease. That's what he's calling the middle way. The Perfect Wisdom text describes it as realization of suchness beyond attainment of good or bad. Ever present with all things as both the path and the goal. So what do these mysterious words mean? They're describing being time, when we are what we are, doing what we're doing, the joy in that experience, when we're out of gaining or losing, out of duality. They describe being in the present moment, in this complete non-referential ease. You can call it shikantaza, too. You can call it being the breath. counting the breath. One teacher said, the middle path does not go from here to there. It goes from there to here. It doesn't go from here to there. It goes from there to here. And we do know the experience. Each of us knows the experience of being present, right? We've been present. If you've had a baby, I'm sure you've been present. By the way, that's where all Buddhas come from. We know this too, right? We know where all Buddhas come from. When we discover the middle path, we neither remove ourselves from the world, nor do we get lost in it. That's the middle way. We don't remove ourselves, and we don't get lost. So that's the edge we're walking. But we get lost, or we're on top of our game. We can be with all our experience in its complexity, with our own exact thoughts and feelings and drama, and at the same time, embrace the tension of holding the opposites of the dualities, of the seeming paradox, of change, of fear. And this, feel the support. I've talked about the earth as our relative. To feel the support to release, to complete non-referential ease. Instead of waiting for the chord at the end of the song, which seeking resolution, we let ourselves hold the tension of the opposites, open and relax in the middle, unresolved. This is a lot of life, isn't it? I mean, maybe I'm on some hermit mountain. Somebody asked me at the Beyond Fear, we had to say our pronouns, and what popped out of me was she, her, hermit. And I thought, you know what? That's my pronouns right now. In the middle, we discover the world is workable. The world is workable when we can be on that. So how often do we hear the teaching to open to the way things are? We can just be like, skip it over. Just open to the way things are. And it's always a search, like, what actually is that saying? How are things? There is a way things are. There is a way things are. That's that naturalness. That's where we relax, so that can reveal itself. That's the active edge of patience. Patience, the character, the Chinese characters for patience is you're in a corner and there's an arrow pointing to your heart. Those are the two characters. So it's right at the heart level. And you're there on that edge, pointing to your heart. Not trapped. Because we can always imagine more perfect conditions, right? The world according to me. How it should be ideally. How everyone should behave. God, don't you do that? If they'd only behave like I want them to, this would be a better world. But it's not our task to create the ideal. It's our task to see how it is and to learn from it as it is. Because as it is way, if we don't see that, there's going to be the fight or the tension. We're going to be on one side or the other. right? We're going to drop off. For the awakening of the heart, conditions are always good enough. And I was thinking of this woman that I've been in touch with for a number of years. She came to a session a while ago. Her attributes are she's a 51-year-old social worker. She's worked for years in a clinic in New York City, a committed meditator, and she took time off to come to Sesshin. And at first, it was really hard for her to quiet her mind. She was coming in. Her younger brother had been re-entered into a psychiatric ward for the second schizophrenic break. She said she was just utterly, because she was taking care of him, utterly flooded with emotion, overwhelmed by fear, confusion, shakiness, anger, grief, all of it. I said, yeah, of course you are. Of course you are. You have this close relationship. Yes, it's happening. Of course. You should be shaking. Of course. And then I said, can you let it all be just as it is? Can you let it all be? To just sit and walk on the earth and let it settle in its own time. And then she came in and said, she sat and the feelings got stronger. And the stories got stronger. And I remembered this piece by Ajahn Chah, and I decided I would read her his teaching. Sitting like a clear forest pool, like a clear, all kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. I encouraged her to acknowledge, one by one, all the inner wild animals that come and drink at the pool. So she started to name them. Fear of loss of control, fear of death, this is what I remember, and I'm adding some of my own probably. Fear of living fully, grief, clinging to a previous relationship, longing for a partner but wanting to be independent, fear for her brother, anxiety about money, anger at the healthcare system, she had to battle at her job every day, and gratitude for her coworkers. And then to sit in the middle of all of it. The paradox, the messiness, the hopes, and the fears. For her, for all of us. To take our seat like a queen on a throne. Allow the play of life, the joys and the sorrows, the fears and the confusions, the birth and death around us, and not to think that we have to fix anything or we even possibly can. Stop managing. Things come up, and then we move away from the natural unfolding. It's what we're programmed for, is to move away. It's like ancient. Right? But we move like a river. We've seen rivers meander through tributaries here and there. That's our life, flowing through the tributary streams, flow through the darkness. It's unfolding. It's coming down like water over rocks, over twigs, over leaves. And then we start to manage. It's all going fine. And it's like, now we want to build like one of those Buddhas. Or we don't like this rock here because it's not flowing quite right, so we're going to move it over here. And then we decide we don't like the sound, so we're going to build a few up so it has a little ledge and a little trickle instead of a roaring stream. Let's change the sound. Let's make a hole. Maybe make a separate pool, because I can then put my chair out by the pool, not realizing, though, it might become stagnant and a breeding ground for mosquitoes. I still want to make my little thing. We start to control the air, the earth, the water, because we can. Because we can. But it's not often in balance. We don't listen to the voices of the insentient who have their perfect balance. We go overboard. I go overboard, not serving my naturalness. And when we find it, then we know, we see it. We see it more clearly. And then we know when to relax it, relax it. And she did this, this woman, to practice just sitting and walking, allow it to be. Intense feelings will come and go. They will. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. So she did this. She relaxed, and gradually she came more still and present. Her meditation felt more spacious. The strong sense states and feelings that arose seemed more like impersonal waves of energy. Her body became lighter. She actually started to speak about joy. And 2 days later, things got worse. She came down with the flu. And I just remind her again, you've got the flu. Now you sit in the middle of that. I saw her the next day, and she was still and happy, not feeling well. It was new for her. She says, I've returned to the center. I'm not going to let my past karma and these obstacles rob me of my presence. She was laughing, saying, like the Buddha, I realized, oh, this is Mara. I just say, I see you, Mara. Mara can be my grief. Mara can be my hopes. Mara can be my body pain and my fear. All of it is just life. And the middle way is so deep, because it's all of them and it's none of them. It's always here. It's all of it and none of it. It's always here. And I've been in touch with her now over several years since she left that session. And her outer circumstances have not really improved. Her work, her brother, her health are still difficulties she continues to face. But her heart is more at ease. Her heart is more at ease. This is life. This is her life. She's working it. She's living it. She's present in it. She sits quietly almost every day in this, in the messiness, if you want to call it that. And she tells me that her zazen has helped her find the middle path and the inner freedom she had always longed for. So that middle way is so deep. It's all of them and none of them. It's always here. There's no reference point. The mind with no reference point does not resolve itself, does not fixate and grasp. No, I feel like I this is like the tenor of the day, this not doing this. It's until we becomes natural. We're becoming natural. And sometimes it's more fluid than others, but sometimes you have to be so attentive to watch and be attentive and relaxing the heart. You might see me a lot do this. That's what I'm doing. That's what I have to do to get it in. That's my remembrance. I push. I touch. I tell a lot of you, you know, remember the earth. You know, I'll sometimes, you ever see the Indian dancers when they come out to dance, the first thing they do is feel the support. Feel the support for the whole being. How could we possibly have no reference point? Really? Don't believe a word I say. Find it for yourself. I tell you, it's possible. It's really possible. It's like, and then you freak out because it's happening. You're getting natural, and now you have to get a reference point very quickly because it's so something we're not used to. But this, to have a no reference point, really upsets a very, very deep-seated habitual response to the world, wanting to make it one way or the other. If it can't do this or that, we'll die. It feels like that sometimes. To not go to the left or to the right, we have withdrawal symptoms. Like that's what I feel like. And I see my mind just want to go. Like, and I'm like, once we know enough about it, you can't play it anymore. It's like you go here and you're like, damn, that's not going to do, that doesn't do it. And then you go this side and you're like, damn, can't play that card either. And so at some point, if we do that enough and cry enough, maybe we surrender. And the surrender is in that, in the mind state and in the heart state. And you, it can, it's possible. It's not denying and it's not supplying. It's just a real surrender to what is. And that edginess, as I said, can feel pretty heavy. We're alone, totally alone, with the uncomfortable edginess that we've been trying to get around, going this way and that, and we see that even if we know we're loved, we are loved, we are so loved. Oh my God, if you don't feel the love, just look at a plant, just look at a tree, they'll tell you. We are so seen and unseen. It's here. However, after constantly doing this spin for all these years, going to yes and no, going right to wrong, black and white, it's this, it's that, has that really changed anything? I have in my room, Ikkyo made me two very beautiful linen cloths with frilly little edges, like a peasant top, nice and starched. And on one it is sewed yes, and on the other is sewed no. So I have them in my room, I hang them. And it's not like which will I choose today, because sometimes there's a yes and sometimes there's a no. But it's just to hold them, yes and no. Like just, I wake up and they're there, right? Our leg hurts from sitting cross-legged, so we move them. And then we feel, whew. And then in a few minutes, oh boy, it's kind of like that. And we move them again. We keep moving around seeking, seeking, seeking. And that kind of satisfaction, and some of it is short-lived, but helpful, just to know it's possible. Pema says, Chodron writes, we hear a lot about the pain of samsara, and we also hear about liberation, but we don't hear much about how painful it is to going from being completely stuck to becoming unstuck. I love that. To become unstuck requires tremendous courage and bravery, completely changing our way of perceiving. It's like changing our DNA, really, because some of it feels and could be our DNA. We are undoing a pattern that is not just our pattern. It's a human pattern. Drawing back the things we project onto the world, the 10 million possibilities with we cook up to attain resolution. Like the brighter, whiter teeth, even. The world without embarrassment. I'd like to cook that one up. Our knight, or our queen in shining armor, who's going to scoop us. Not only do we seek resolution, but we feel that we deserve resolution, perhaps. We feel we deserve resolution. And yet we suffer from resolution. An open state of mind to relax and ambiguity. And if we don't know or see that life is uncertain, we will have that withdrawal. It's the certainties we seek, yeah. I don't know, probably you've gotten to that place sometimes where you just shake your head this way, and I have no clue. I have no clue. And then to rest, like when that comes, is very difficult. But it actually might bring a little chuckle. The middle way, wide open. It's amazing how we don't want to feel what we feel, but get to some other place quickly. We don't want that withdrawal. We want the resolution. Like, I should be able, the deserving part, I should be able to figure this out. It's figure outable. In a sense, yes. In a sense, no. But what is the figure outable? What's at the end of that? The middle way encourages us to do just that, to sit in the feeling, to awaken to the courage that exists in us, that exists in everyone without exception. To not judge what arises in our mind. Tall order. But we can. We actually can not judge what arises in our mind. We have to really know that. But we go to that. That's well worn. It's well worn. It's the habit. To not even grasp whatever arises in our mind. Simply acknowledge thinking. That's what we're doing. We're offered the guidance to let go of thoughts, let the thoughts come and go, as if we're touching a bubble with a feather. Touching a bubble with a feather. I was in a woman's program. I hope I get this right. Some of you can maybe help me if I... And a woman had to come up and tell her maybe like her most painful story, while another woman was just really appreciating her in her pain and had a feather. And as she's telling the story, she's just holding her in it with such, like she's looking at the most beautiful thing in the universe and caressing her anywhere, like with this feather as she's telling her story. And it was amazing, like that the two of them together, like you imagine, like you're trying to get involved in this and you're just feeling this, somebody like loving you and just going, oh, sweetie. Like not saying it, but just just appreciating, loving you in this peace. It really works. Like I tried it, I watched it, but then I wanted to do it, so I did it with someone. We exchanged. It was interesting to do. You can even do it to yourself. I did it to this my grandniece. She's 6, and she was all uppity, and I told her she was the most beautiful thing in the world, you know, with this feather, you know, and she couldn't, you know, she was all anxious, and she couldn't hold the opposites like that. She couldn't hold the sensation and the feeling of being connected with where she wanted to go. It was really, really a nice moment together. And I find there are particular, very particular feelings that can be so full with wanting a resolution. There's some I live with day to day, and that will come up, like, how come, what? And I'll be like, I have no answer. I've really exhausted myself. And I just have to let something be natural. Loneliness is one of them, a big one. Anxiety, our anxiety, staying in the middle of what, when we experience it. We can relax with these feelings. We can. It's the antidote the Buddha prescribed for the illness. I have an example, like if somebody left us in our life and we don't want to be with that raw discomfort, we might then, for example, draw up that familiar identity as the one who is discarded, the one who's always left, right? So this is a no-blame practice. That was a hard... My teacher one time nailed me on that. Daito Roshi, son of a gun. In his dying days, he finally, like, did... That was the strongest teaching of one of my strongest teachings from him. I've never had the guts to even tell it. But I was at his house, he was dying, and he was doing a book signing, and there was no way he needed to sign all these books. And Zuisei, I'll blame it on Zuisei for the moment, but she said to me, Daito's gonna say, get me more books. But don't do it. He doesn't need all those books. So he's signing and we run out and he says, could you get me more books? There's thousands of them. And so I say, like, Zuise said, you don't need any more books. And he, in his frailty, shut his eyes and he looked at me and he said, Hojin, you have to stop blaming people. And you won't believe it, for the next few months, I tried to change that in my mind, like I misunderstood what he said, and I changed it into, people are always blaming you, or something like different than it was, because I actually could not let that in and look at it. I could not see. It has taken me, he died in 2009, I think at least like several more years to study that and see the profundity of how I would still do it. Like somebody in my life somewhere was doing something to me. And they might be, but that's their biz. I want my present moment. I want my life. I don't want it hooked into what happened, the past. This is hard. This is this hard edge. And I never went back and asked him, what did you say? I didn't want him to say it again. I never told anyone this for a long time. Who doesn't want to cover the pain in one way or another? Heartache isn't something we choose to invite in, but it's the great can opener too. It's the great can opener. When we can rest in the middle, when we begin to have a non-threatening relationship with loneliness, we can cool the loneliness that completely turns our usual fearful patterns upside down. And so I wanted to share with you something I remember reading a while ago, where Pema Chodron distinguishes, you may have read it before, hot and cool loneliness. Hot is letting our loneliness drive us into acting like a hot mess, impulsively engaging in escape behaviors to avoid the uncomfortable feeling of being lonely. These behaviors bring short-term relief, and we often regret them later. The cool loneliness doesn't mean too cool to be lonely, but rather having a sense of contentment and acceptance of our loneliness without a need to alleviate it. That's where we mature. And she speaks of six kinds of cool loneliness. Desire, contentment, avoiding unnecessary activity, complete discipline, and not wandering in the world of desire, and not seeking security from one's discursive thoughts. I'll just go over it briefly. Less desire is the willing to be lonely without resolution when everything in us yearns for something to cheer us up and change our mood. Practicing this kind of loneliness is a way of sowing seeds so that the fundamental restlessness decreases. You follow? That coolness? In Zazen, we label thinking instead of getting endlessly run around by our thoughts. We train in being here without disassociating. We practice less desire wholeheartedly and consistently when something shifts. We feel less solidly seduced by our storylines. That's a cool loneliness. So even if the hot loneliness is there for 2 seconds, if we sit in that restlessness, there's the path of courage opening up. 2 seconds. One can be lonely and not tossed away by it. The second of contentment, we have nothing, absolutely nothing to lose, but being programmed in our guts to feel we have a lot to lose. Our feelings that we have a lot to lose is rooted in fear of loneliness, of change, of anything that can't be resolved, of not existing. when we lose the reference point and face the fear of truth, of no ground, really, we can draw a line and stand on the right side as someone, and we or stand on the left side. That was a little confusing. When we draw, so we can draw a line down the center. We don't have to stand on the right or the left. Who are we when we don't put ourselves on either side, when we just don't know what to do? And we have to surrender a billion times. Then, without even noticing, something begins to shift. She says, we can just be lonely with no alternatives, content to be right here with the mood and the texture of what's happening. I love her. She's so earthy, just clear, telling it like it is. Loneliness is avoiding unnecessary activity, in avoiding unnecessary activities. When we're lonely and it's really heated up in us, we look for something to save us. We look for a way out. We get this nauseous feeling that we are so alone. Our minds go wild trying to come up with companions from the despair. So that's what she's calling unnecessary activity, keeping ourselves busy so we don't have to feel any pain. Gossiping, daydreaming. The point is, are we seeking companionship in our usual habitual way, distancing ourselves from that demon that's at the heart of it? The poet Ryokan says, if you want to find the meaning, stop chasing after many things. Complete discipline is another aspect of cool loneliness. It means at every opportunity, we're willing to come back, just gently come back to the present moment. And not wandering off in the world of desire is that not looking for alternatives. Food, drink, people. When desire has that addictive quality, the way we grab to make things okay. It's, for me, it's that moment of, I want my mommy. We still want to go home and be able to open the refrigerator and find it full of our favorite goodies when it gets tough. But we're leaving home, not wandering, but relating to things how they are. The last is not seeking security from our discursive thoughts. Let's see if I can. It's all encouragement to look honestly, without aggression, at our own minds, dropping those ideals I spoke of. The middle way, the sacred path of a bodhisattva. When we wake up in the morning, and out of nowhere comes heartache of alienation, this is it. And to find that as a really golden opportunity, rather than that feeling that persecuting ourselves that something's wrong with us. It's just a moment of sadness and longing. Can we relax and touch the limitless space of our heart? Do you have any relatives? Yes. Where are they? The mountains, rivers, the whole earth, the plants and trees are all my relatives. She's showing us the way in, the limitless space of our human heart that reaches and is related to everything. That's what we deserve. That's our birthright. That is the middle way. Just as the birds enjoy the sky and deer enjoy the meadow, do the wise dwelling in nirvana. an open state of body and mind to relax within ambiguity, our naturalness in holding no reference point as our relatives, this great Heart Sutra, mother of all Buddhas.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.